The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 596 for Sunday, March 13th, one day short of Pi Day, but Pi is a lie, and I'm going to tell you why.
2015. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, tips, and cool stuff found, and like Car Talk for Apple geeks, we answer your questions, share your tips, share your cool stuff found. The goal is to learn at least three new things each and every time we get together. Sponsors for this episode include Gazelle at gazelle.com, where you can sell off all your old stuff and buy some new to you refurbished stuff. We'll talk about that. A new sponsor for us here, HelloFresh at hellofresh.com, where promo code MGG will save you $35 off your first order of some fantastic food. And I'll tell you more about how that works in a minute. I also want to tell you that I made a mistake in one of our more recent spots for the company Betterment, BETTERMENT.com/MGG. When you visit that, what I neglected to mention is that depending on how much you invest, you can get up to 6 months for free using that betterment.com/MGG link. So I wanted to make sure I made that very, very clear for all of you. You really should check that out. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, and I have to explain myself. This is John F. Braun, but let me explain myself. So some of you may know, and yes, I will stop doing that. Tomorrow is what many call Pi Day, because it's 3/14, which if you know what pi is, which is a number that a lot of us like, if you're into math or things like that, or circles, is 3/14. But I would argue, and that's why
the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter is what pi represents.
But the reason I say that pi is a lie, Dave, is because for all practical purposes, a lot of times you really want to use something called tau. And I'll post a link to it, but tau is basically 2 pi. And again, for a lot of calculations, you're going to be using tau anyways. So that's why I'm saying pi is a lie. But I will link to the article. But you can celebrate both. So I encourage people to celebrate both Pi Day, which is going to be Monday, and also Tau Day, which would be June 28th, right? So
well,
go for it. Though I'm not sure. I mean, of course, on Pi Day, you would celebrate with a pie. I'm not sure what the appropriate celebratory vehicle is for Tau Day. But we got time to work on that.
Yeah. I feel like if we can find somewhere, you know, the people that live around me here in sort of northern New England, and especially emanating from Boston, tend to drop their R's quite a bit. So what we need to do is find somewhere where they colloquially tend to drop their L's, and then we can celebrate Towel Day on 6/28, and we'll be just fine. So we need to make ourselves honorary members of whatever community that might be. And then there you go. I don't know.
Is that Towel Day?
No. I'm just saying we could make it. We can push this. It's bullheaded persistence, John, is what we're going to figure out. We're going to use to figure this out. So, yes.
According to my records, Towel Day, which is to celebrate Douglas Adams,
yes,
and that it looks to be Wednesday, May 25th. So,
was that Douglas Adams'
calendars.
Birthday? Is that right?
It would appear that's the case. I just Googled Tau Day,
right,
and it came up with that. So,
right.
So we got all sorts of oddball holidays that regular people don't celebrate.
Yeah, but then what do we do for Tau Day? We gotta find, is it the day that we celebrate our neighbors on Tau Ceti? I don't know.
Or you could just have two pies.
Oh, see, now you're talking. That's twice as good as Pi Day. I like the way you think. See, we're just spitballing here, and we're coming up with good stuff. I like this. This is good. Speaking of good stuff, we have some quick tips to share. So let's jump to Jeremy. He says, I discovered something about an earlier tip that might help some others. Pressing Shift Command Control 4 will let you take a screenshot and copy it to your clipboard instead of creating a file. And the control key is the differentiator there. Just Command Shift 4 would save the screenshot to your desktop. Adding the control into it saves it to your clipboard. He says, I found out today that you don't actually have to press control with the other three keys. My hand cramps up trying to get all four at the same time, but you can get away with just Command Shift 4 to start taking the screenshot. And before releasing the mouse button for the shot to be saved, hold down the control key. That will save some wear and tear on my hands. It also saves you from if you hit Command Shift 4 and then realize, ooh, I wanted to do this to the clipboard instead. Just add the control key in as you're pushing the mouse button and it will put it on your clipboard. So thank you, Jeremy. Good stuff. We had both Dr. Mac, Bob Levitis, and Allison Sheridan from podfeet.com, from NozillaCast, write in and say, we were talking about that little icon at the top of document windows. And Bob says that is called the proxy icon. And you can do one more thing with it that you guys didn't mention. Pressing Command and Option while you drag it will allow you to create an alias to the document. He says, I use this one all the time. So thank you, Bob. Thank you, Allison. Thank you, everyone, for chiming in about that. Good stuff. John, you had something to add to this, yes?
Well, what I added is, so in the lovingly handcrafted show notes, I will often, if appropriate, post a link to something that has more information. And in the show notes for 594, I did, among the chatter I saw about the proxy icon, did find a rather splendid article over at Macworld. I don't recall the author, but it talks, I think it has 8 amazing things that you can do with the proxy icon.
Oh, nice. So we got to put that in again. Yeah. We'll put that into this one too. Yeah.
So we shall. It's little, but it has the potential to do a lot if you fiddle with the keyboard.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Sticking with quick tips here for a little bit. David says, I have an iMac that I back up using a Thunderbolt attached Drobo Mini. It works flawlessly for this purpose. However, I recently swapped out the hard drive for an SSD, and when I attempted the recovery, the drive was not recognized. After contacting Drobo support, their advice was to remove the Thunderbolt cable and use a USB cable, retry, and bingo, it worked. My iMac was mid-2011, so it's only USB 2, not USB 3. Recovery took longer than I expected. This is somehow a limitation of the iMac, according to Drobo, and that it only supports recovery from USB and not Thunderbolt. Might be a good tip for those who have a similar setup and might limit the hair pulling if you need to do a recovery. And that is true. I don't have the list in front of me. Maybe we can come up with it before the end of the show, and we'll put it in the show notes of which Macs it is that you cannot do Thunderbolt recovery. But I know that there are many of them. We've heard about this from many of you over the years that have attempted it. So thank you very kindly for that, David. Good stuff. Anything to add on that before we jump to Jim here, John?
I don't think I'm ready for it. I was going to, there was something about target disk mode and the various interfaces here, but I don't have anything that I have hands-on experience with, so I'm okay. Just not going to mention it.
All right.
So, sorry.
That's okay. No. Processing out loud. Well, gotcha.
I do believe that the very latest Macs do support target disk mode using USB, or is it Thunderbolt? That's what I'm scratching my head over.
Definitely USB, and I think Thunderbolt as well. But yeah, this would be good to get clarity on.
I believe that was not the case on earlier Macs. I remember having a spirited discussion with a lot of the Mac cool kids about this. And
got it.
And it certainly was not an option on the very first Macs, but I believe on the latest Thunderbolt will support the target disk mode, which basically makes your disk look like an external drive.
Gotcha. Cool. All right. Going to Jim now. Jim said, I ran into a problem a couple of days ago that I thought was worth sharing. I was using one of my iCloud email accounts and replied to a message that had a couple hundred recipients. It was a meeting invitation. The reply all was appropriate since it contained information for everyone participating. Shortly after I hit the send button, I tried sending another email from the same account and received a message telling me that I had exceeded my daily sending limit. Since I found an Apple support article, which we'll, of course, put in the show notes, where I learned that all users have a limit of 200 outgoing mails per day. I guess I should have known that, but I didn't. I also think I've learned that each addressee in that reply all must have counted as a send because there were only a few, less than 10, other messages sent before that. So the only way I could have reached the limit was if the addressee counted as a sent email. Anyway, I wasn't able to send from that account for 24 clock hours. So apparently it's not a calendar day, but a true 24-hour clock. Thank you, Jim. Yeah, it's interesting because I'm not, the way the support article reads, I'm not convinced. It says the total number of messages you can send each day is 200. The number of recipients you can message each day is 1,000. And the maximum number of recipients per message is 100. So I'm not sure what went on here. It may be that you overdid your recipients per message and hit the limit. And so it stopped you for 24 hours, even though you hadn't sent 200 messages. I think that's probably where you hit. So it's very interesting how this all works, but we'll put that in the show notes so that you guys have it.
I ran into this a while ago.
Ah, okay.
Well, I was using my iCloud or my .Mac email. So I was kind of volunteered to do our last high school reunion.
Yeah.
And we have just over 100 people in our graduating class. And I found out what this limit was, which was 100.
Yeah.
Because I tried sending an email out to over 100 people saying, hey, you know, can you confirm your mailing address and, you know, this info? And it came back. And at least it comes back to you telling you that you blew it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Jim was not left wondering what happened. That's right. Yeah. Which is good because sometimes you'll run into those things and it's just like, hey, you know.
Or the ISP just. Yeah, they just don't do it.
Yeah.
And you have no clue as to what went wrong. So and they did that. I think they said, you know, you got to back off a bit. So I had to segment my queries into groups of 100 or less.
Right. Right.
Great.
Right. All right. And lastly, on the quick tip front, anyway, we've got plenty more show for you folks. PJ wrote in and said, I use if you are in Chrome or Safari and are browsing and find a site of interest, just hit Command Shift I and it will copy the link, title, and email and put the link in the email ready to send to someone. And he says he also uses Command L to get to the address bar quickly. And in Safari and Chrome, that gets to Google search without having to get to the Google website, which of course is very handy. Yeah, Command L is one of those that's baked into my fingers when I'm browsing and probably all of yours too. But if it's not, give it a try. You will find how efficient you can be in a web browser with your keyboard. So thank you very much, PJ. Thanks for everybody for sending in all of your quick tips. We love those things. It's good stuff. Anything to add on this one, John, before we move on to questions?
Not this one.
Okay.
The next one, but.
All right.
We'll wait.
Well, yeah, we'll move on. All right, cool. So Martin writes, he says, I'm running out of space on my MacBook Air. And that's why I was looking with Omni Disk Sweeper to see what big files are on my hard drive. Great, great thinking. He says, I found one big file of 5.9 gigs in user library application support, Google Chrome, default file system 000/P/00. He says, what I'm wondering is if I can delete this file or do I need to clear it in another way? I've Googled a little and found where someone mentions it could have something to do with downloading large files. And I've recently used Chrome to download a file of about that size. So it looks like that makes sense, but I'm wondering now what I can do with that file and how to delete it. Yeah. These files are in that folder are failed downloads or downloads that, you know, didn't process. The way Chrome does it is it stores its downloads here while they're in progress. And then when they're finished, it moves them to the download folder. This one, for whatever reason, it sounds like it got, you know, pretty much to the end and just didn't complete that last little bit to trigger the final sort of rewrite. And so that's what happens. And yes, you can just safely delete those, no problem, and free up your disk space. And running, you know, running Omni Disk Sweeper like Martin did here, great thing to do on a, you know, I probably do it 3, maybe 4 times a year on my drives. And it's a handy thing. We've got an article. You can run it, you know, just kind of normally. There are other pieces of software out there that do the same thing. It basically just scours your drive and shows you where all the big files are and what folders are the biggest. And it sorts everything by space. And so you can just sort of traverse through and see where these things are, because there will be things hiding. I like the Omni Disk Sweeper interface, but again, there's others. It's, you know, Daisy Disk, I think, is one of them. And again, there's others, but, if you run Omni Disk Sweeper in normal mode, it will not see files that are only readable by the root user. So we've got a little article that's many years old, but still very, very current, that shows you how to use the terminal to run Omni Disk Sweeper in full privileged mode and see everything. And that can also be handy. So we'll put that in the show notes for you. So, John?
And here's my story, Dave. So it's a little tangent, but I think it's relevant.
Okay.
And it ties into some things that you mentioned here. So I think I was telling you, and I'll tell everybody else here. So I was having a problem with my transporter.
Okay.
Transporter being a kind of cloudish backup
private
device.
Private cloud. Yeah.
Yeah. Private cloud. And so I had one of those, and I was having issues with it. I was having one issue, which I think was based on my switch being wonky. But then, Dave, the thing would just die on me. And I'm like, you know what? I think it's the hard drive. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pop the hard drive out of it, and I'm going to put another hard drive in there. And when you do this, the device is smart. It's like, okay, I'm going to reformat the hard drive using my, you know, it's a Unix-y format. And then it went through the motions of re-uploading or re-mirroring all the data that I told it to. One of the nice features of it is you can say, okay, back up all my pictures, my documents, you know, a number of the special folders.
Sure.
So as it was going through the motions of redoing this, because it was a new hard drive, I noticed that I had a Time Machine backup, Dave, that all of a sudden took 300 gigabytes. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty huge.
Yeah.
Gigabytes, folks. No, not megabytes, gigabytes. And I'm like, wow. Now, the thing is that the things I was telling the transporter to sync to it were, in fact, that large. So I did what you said, Dave. So there's a tie-in here. So I ran our pal Omni Disk Sweeper, and I said, you know what? Please tell me what this huge file is. And it's like, oh, you know what? It's in your user directory, library, application support, and it was a file called connecteddata.connecteddata, which they were using, and I don't think it was the wrong thing to do.
No.
They were using it as a big old honking cache. The thing is, because I was syncing such massive amounts of data, one of them being about 300 gigabytes in size, which was some of my photo libraries, it cached that to my hard drive. So a little tip here, you may want to. So what I've done from that point forward, and then I'm having other issues with it. It looks like the device itself may have died.
Right,
but,
right.
What I did is I said, you know what? Let's exclude that particular file, which I think is either a file or directory, let's exclude that from Time Machine. And what I also did, Dave, though, and I think this is probably a wise move for anybody, and I'd like your thought on it, but I also excluded /library/caches and my user directory /library/caches.
From Time Machine?
From Time Machine.
It's automatic. You don't have to do that. It automatically doesn't copy that stuff.
Really?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
All right, yep. It's odd because it let me add them as exclusions. It didn't say I already exclude that.
Yeah.
It would make sense to me that it wouldn't back those up.
I'm 90% certain that it doesn't back those up, because I've looked in backups and I'm pretty sure they haven't been there. But you're right that it's absolutely ridiculous to want to back those up. That's, you know, anything stored in the caches folder should be data that is not unique to your system, right? Or not recreatable by your system. That's sort of the point of a cache. And yeah, I'm pretty sure Time Machine excludes that automatically, but there's no harm in adding it to the exclusions list. Yeah.
Right. So I guess the story is, yeah. So things in application support are not, obviously from what I saw here, are not automatically excluded. And depending on the app, again, I don't blame these guys for doing this. It kind of makes sense that they cache it before they upload it, mm-hmm. and they have to put it somewhere. But if your Time Machine backups are getting monstrously huge, break out Omni Disk Sweeper and exclude that bad boy if it doesn't make sense to back it up to Time Machine, which in this case, I really don't think it did.
Yep. Totally. All right. Good stuff. Moving on to Barry, I think. And if I did this right, Barry was, I'm certain of this. Barry was the very first one he was the very first one to sign up for Mac Geek Gab Premium years and years ago. And he was the very first one to call in to our new Google voice number of 224-888-GEEK. John, Geek is?
4335.
That's right. There were many of you that called in this week that answered our call by calling. So thank you for that. I think Booker was one, and I want to say Mark was another. There were several this week. But Barry was the first, which, again, no great surprise. Here is what Barry had to say.
Hey, Dave, John, and Pete, it's Barry. Hope you are doing well. A quick question about voice over LTE. I've noticed that with AT&T, if I call people who are on the same network in the Chicago area, I get some really nice, crisp, clear connections, and they're lighting up other areas as well. So I was just in Vegas. They work great coming back to Chicago. My wife, however, is on Verizon, so we don't get that benefit. Now, I do have a work test phone that's on Verizon, and I tried that, and that also worked really well, Verizon to Verizon. Is there any way that these carriers will get together so we can do one carrier to another and still take advantage of this? Just kind of curious what the technical options are, if it's possible, if it's just a matter of them being carriers and just not playing nicely with each other. Looking forward to your thoughts. Thanks so much.
You bet, Barry. Thank you. Voice over LTE, new thing with, I believe, just the iPhone 6, but I could be wrong about that, or the 6S, but the 6 might do it too. In fact, I think it does. It's creating a much higher quality voice connection. And you've heard this sometimes if you've got, I think it's iPhone 6 and later, where you get this, you know, it sounds like a Skype call or a FaceTime audio call. It's like, whoa, this is, you know, way clear audio, crystal clear audio. But as Barry points out, when it first rolled out, it was only available within the same carrier. So like he said, he's got AT&T. He can call other AT&T people. Verizon people can call other Verizon people. And if both phones and both networks that they're on at the point of the call allow it, then you get this great quality. But there is no interoperability at current. All of the major networks, AT&T, Verizon, at the front of them, have announced that interoperability is coming. AT&T said they would have it all set with Verizon by the end of 2015. That did not happen, but they have done some field tests, and they are testing this in limited areas where the interoperability works. So my feeling and what they're saying is that certainly this year we will see that that happen. So Barry's question was good because I never really quite understood where all this came from, and it was good to do a little research and demystify it and figure out why it sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. And it depends on which tower you're on. I mean, if you're in a place where you're bouncing between LTE and 4G, well, if you're on 4G, you're not going to get voice over LTE. It sounds obvious when we say it this way, but you know, sometimes in the moment you don't really think about it. So that's what's going on there. So have you had any of those calls, John, the voice over LTE where it's like crystal clear?
Yes, because when I got my shiny new 6S, Dave, one of the first things that was in the box as a little addendum, they said, by the way, you know, because you got this phone and you got the LTEs, go to cellular, enable LTE, and there's going to be three choices. One is off, one is voice and data, and the other is data only. And they say, you probably want to do voice and data.
Right.
It's good for you. But the bad news is LTE, it would appear, is not LTE, at least, not between carriers.
Not between carriers.
Disappointing.
Right, right. Yeah.
And yes, it is iPhone 6 or later, not 6S. So that's the trick. And we'll put a link in the show notes to Apple's page because it tells you what carriers worldwide support it. So interesting stuff. Very, very interesting stuff, in fact. So it's cool. Fun. Moving to, let's go to Ronald, John. You ready to take us there?
I am ready.
Well, let's go.
Ronald's question is very timely because, you know, especially with you know, moving the clocks around here, we're all having problems with,
you know, I want to say something about this, especially as someone who had a gig last night and then had an 8:30 or whose son had an 8:30 a.m. hockey game about an hour away this morning. This spring ahead fall back thing sounds like a really good idea in the fall, but not so much in the spring. Not so much. But bring us there, John.
When you're gaining, yes. When you're losing,
yes.
No.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, but it's over now. So the next one, mm-hmm. we get to bounce back. So that's a good one.
Although I would say ban it.
I would like to abolish it as well. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Well, I think Indiana and I think parts of Arizona. I believe there are a couple of places, and I think Hawaii. Maybe.
Hawaii.
There are a few parts in the U.S. that don't deal with this nonsense because it just. Because I only had like two devices my computers automatically did it. I think my TiVo, I do have an analog clock. Well, it's actually digital behind the scenes, but it actually moves the hands ahead or back at the right time and a weather station. But all my other things I had to do manually. Yeah, it didn't take too long, but still.
So, right. You know, I want to rewind a little bit, John, because there's some discussion in the chat room here about this voice over LTE thing. And several people are talking about how it doesn't work if you're using a microcell, and that is true. It does not work if you're using a microcell because AT&T's microcell puts out a 3G signal. Here's the thing, and I was someone who I own two microcells, and I have owned three because one of them died, and I bought a new one. They were a great device. So the microcell is this device that plugs into is AT&T's name or brand name for their device. Other carriers have the same concept where it's a device that plugs into your local network and creates a little kind of individualized cell tower in your house using a data connection over your, you know, your broadband connection to get voice calling to you. And it was the best solution you could get if you were in like a weird kind of pocket where you didn't get great cell service at your house, or your office. You plug in one of these things, you authorize a certain number of phones to use it, and everybody's happy. However, since the introduction of the iPhone 6, many of the carriers now and devices support Wi-Fi calling. And since all of our devices in my house now support that, we turned off our microcells. And the benefit is the benefits are many. One of them is that, you know, we're not limited to this this issue of not being able to use LTE things over. I mean, the 3G data on that microcell was just slow, and you would pay AT&T for it anyway. So if you forgot to turn on Wi-Fi or whatever, but it's been much, much better for us. So if all of the phones in your house are capable of doing Wi-Fi calling, turn off, just unplug your microcell. That's all I did. Just pull the plug from the wall. We're automatically now on Wi-Fi calling in the house, and things are much, much better. And so there you go. So I just wanted to share that since there was some chatter going on about it. You ready to take us to Ronald? Unless you have something more about Wi-Fi calling, John.
Well, we Verizon folk do not have that as of yet.
Seriously? I thought Verizon approved it months ago.
That's the word.
But you can't use it?
Well, I don't see it.
I thought they rolled it out in like back in December.
Well, should it be in the screen?
No, you're right. It's not. You won't get it until iOS 9.3. You should put the developer beta on your phone.
Yeah. No.
Okay, so now we'll take another tangent off of this tangent. I am running the developer beta of 9.3 on both my iPad and my iPhone now. I typically put it on my iPad because it's a device I use all the time, but it's not mission critical. So that's where I sort of test out these things. So I have some working knowledge of these features when it comes out. But one of the features, that night shift feature, once you have it, it was impossible for me going back and forth between my iPad and my iPhone and even my Mac at night. The white point, you know, it moves it from this very blue thing to a much, you know, yellower, redder white point to soften the kind of the glare and the burn on your eyes at night. And I love it on the iPad. And so I immediately downloaded Flux for my Mac because I had to do the same thing there. And I just matched it to my iPad's colors so that it's all the same. And then, of course, I had to put it on my iPhone. So that night shift mode, when that comes, and my guess is a week from tomorrow, we will hear the release date for 9.3 if it's not out already, you know, with Apple having that announcement on the 21st. So anyway, I throw that out there. Once you've got that, be prepared. And Flux is free for the Mac. We'll put a link for that in the show notes. So there you go. Now you want to take us finally, John? You want to stop dilly-dallying and take us to Ronald?
Me dilly-dally. No, it happens. All right. So Ronald has a good one. Dig deep. Well, we'll dig as deep as we need to here. But so Ronald says, hey, guys. And he says he enjoys the show. And we enjoy that you enjoy the show, because we're all in this together. But he says, I've been having a problem with my iMac that has been getting a lot worse recently. Sometimes I can't wake the machine after it has gone to sleep. When I move the mouse, the pointer moves on a black screen, but I don't get the login screen. Eventually, I use the power switch on the back. This used to happen every few weeks. Now it is happening every day or so. I'm debating three choices. Nuke and Pave. Never done this. Talk to Genius Bar to have them check it out. Okay. Buy a new machine. All right, we don't need any more there. My machine is a Mac 27-inch Lee 2009 processor, memory. I don't think any of that is really important. And he's running El Capitan. I'm able to SSH into the iMac from the iPad using Coda on the iPad, but I'm not technical enough to know what to look for. I looked at some of the logs, but I'm not sure what to look for. All right. So here's my take. So I had referring to looking in the logs. So he's SSHing in, but I'm almost certain what you can do is once you do get into the machine, rather than SSHing, you can go to the console. So one thing you can search for when you're in the console, so you set up the console, and typically you're going to be highlighting a category, and probably the best one to highlight in this case would be the one at the very top, which is all messages. You can do a subset, but I would do all messages just to make sure.
Sure.
You're being thorough. And I would search for the word sleep, because what you will get, well, I'm going to give you a couple of words to search for. So one is sleep, because you will see, and so I searched on my system, Dave, and you will see probably reasons for the machine both waking or not waking and sleeping. So for example, in my case, I looked at the most recent on my on the machine that I was running it on. And it has, so first it's a message from the kernel, because the kernel does handle this sort of thing. And one message I saw, it said, oh, wake reason, ec.sleeptimer. Okay, well, you woke up because, you know, some timer told me to. Okay, that's good. You may also want to search for the term wake, because in this case, although here it gives a reason that it wakes, I'm also suspecting that if it doesn't wake, you're going to get a reason, probably a failure code. The other thing is you could look for the reasons that, this is probably not so applicable here, because if you search for sleep, you're going to see reasons that the machine falls asleep as well. And typically that's based on some setting in PRAM. So where I'm leading, Dave, with this is that there are a couple of other things that I didn't explicitly mention to Ronald, but I'm hoping he's listening to us. So power-related issues with this sounds like, So this is crossing different boundaries here, Dave, because when you have power issues, to me, that almost suggests doing what is known as an SMC reset, which in a lot of cases, it is nothing more than removing power from your Mac and sometimes holding down certain keys. It depends on which machine that you have.
Sure.
Like in the case of my Mac Mini, they say, yeah, basically pull the plug for 15 seconds and that resets the SMC. It may be different for the iMac, though I'm not sure if it actually involves holding down keys on the keyboard or if it's the same sort of thing. It's just remove all power and this thing called the SMC will drain itself and reset.
That's typically what it is. Some laptops where you can't remove the battery have a different process, but yep.
The other thing is that settings for sleep are typically stored in what is known as the PRAM or parameter RAM. And if this gets corrupted or munged, as we like to call it in technical terms, here's the other option. You reset the PRAM. And that is typically command option PR, I think, Dave, if my memory serves me correctly. Because a lot of the things, again, concerning sleep are stored in the PRAM. And I think, again...
That's where I would go with this. Yeah.
And I think if you go into the terminal, I forget. It's PM set, and then I know
where you're going here. So if you want to see the reason that your Mac won't sleep, if you run PM set space dash G from the terminal, it will show you lots of different things, but one of them will be sleep with a number after it, which is how long after it goes idle, your system will actually go to sleep. And then if there's something that has kind of a hold on that, it will show in parentheses, it will say sleep prevented by, and it'll start listing processes. Like on mine right now, it says sleep prevented by Core Audio D.
Core Audio D, yep.
And then Core Audio D, then Core Audio D, then Core Audio D. And I think there's about eight of them. But, you know, I'm running Audio Hijack and routing things all over, you know, Six Ways from Tuesday to make this podcast work the way we like it to. So that makes sense because each one of them puts a hold on it and says, nope, you know, if I'm alive, please do not sleep the system. You know, the user might actually be doing something, even though they're not touching the keyboard. We're using audio. Stay away. Which is right. Cool.
Now, again, his issue could be, his issue is that he can't wake, not that he can't sleep.
Right. Well, he did say that he was having trouble sleeping sort of as a tangential thing, I think, in one of the replies. But you're right. Yeah, the core of the issue was
right.
Waking.
So these absolutely, the sleep reasons will, and in our case, it's pretty obvious. We're running audio. So
sure.
The computer is not going to go to sleep if it detects that we're actively doing something audio, which is kind of smart.
Yep. And that's also true if it's playing, songs from iTunes. It won't just go to sleep randomly in the midst, which is good.
Right. I'm thinking the other thing, now that I look what I see in the PM set dash G, Dave.
Yeah.
It's kind of a long shot here. And it could be dangerous. And actually, I want to get your guidance on this here. But there's another thing that the Mac does when it goes to sleep. And I'm wondering if this is preventing it from waking up.
Okay.
There is something called a sleep image. So this is an image of memory.
That yeah.
When your machine goes to sleep, is saved. Now, I'm wondering is if that file is, again, the technical term is munged.
That's the technical term. That's right. Yes.
But I'm wondering if, now you want to be careful, is that I don't think you want, well, I don't know. I mean, typically it's in /var/vm/sleep image.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if whacking that file may address, I'm wondering if the machine is trying to wake up, but because the sleep image is somehow damaged or messed up.
Yeah.
It's struggling and it's like, I really want to wake up for you, but first I got to load what was in memory and I can't. So, and it sounds like he has to resort to holding down the power button, which is the absolute, not the totally worst thing you could do.
Right.
But it's a pretty severe.
Yeah. I mean, at that
dealing
point
with things and the more you do that, you always want to shut your machine down properly, either through a shutdown or you don't want to hold down the power button to shut down your machine because that just leads to more bad things happening down the road.
Definitely. I mean, I think in his scenario here, there's not a whole lot of options though. So, if the machine, if you can't get it to wake up, you have to shut it off. There's no, Like, you know, it's not like you can SSH in and tell it to restart the nice way. It's not responding to anything. So it's not responding to anything.
Right. So, now, as far as the choices he was debating, I don't necessarily think a nuke and pave is necessary because that takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
But going into recovery and reinstalling the OS, there could be a just mysterious part of the OS that is just, again, these things happen somehow. Damaged,
no, I think your idea had
reinstalling. I mean, the last thing to try would be going into recovery, which you should have available. You know, you start up and you hold down Command R, and reinstalling the OS. I don't think could hurt, and it could maybe repair whatever is. And I guess the old Hail Mary is doing a safe boot, right?
Right. Right. Yep.
That also fixes some, you know, kind of non-specific damage.
It's true, actually, and I would not call that a Hail Mary. I mean, I would do, like you said, I think the SMC reset, you know, that's always the way I think of that is when it feels like hardware and you hope it's not hardware, try an SMC reset because that's sort of, you know, I mean, it's the bridge to hardware, right? And if that gets corrupted, and it does, doing an SMC reset can solve all manner of otherwise wacky issues. So that would be absolutely the first thing, the NVRAM reset with command option PR. That's another one for sure. And then I like your idea of a safe boot because that's going to clean out a lot of things that might be getting in the way. And I would say the fourth thing would be your delete the sleep image file. If a safe boot doesn't do that automatically, and I don't know if that's one of the things that a safe boot does, but I would do all four of those things in that order before resorting to, you know, certainly a nuke and pave or even an over the top reinstall. So, cool.
All right.
Good stuff. Where are we here in our agenda? I know we've got a couple of things. You want to take us to, Larry here, John, and, we will take a sip from Apple's fountain on this one.
Larry, a sip. Oh, I see. Oh, I see what you did there. That was good. All right. Oh,
are we here?
Yeah. Well, we're here, but I don't. All right. I put something. All right. We're kind of out of sync, but I think we're good here.
Okay.
And then I think I had a follow up that I don't see here in my.
Aha.
Maybe I'm missing it. Is there another from Larry here? No, there's not. All right. We'll just roll with it.
Okay.
We're professionals. We can handle this.
Right. Yeah.
So he says, hey, guys, so ever since El Capitan came out and I was told that I could not use Total Finder because system integrity protection was on, I've been worried about the integrity of my system. Aren't we all? I really want to use Total Finder, but I don't want to compromise the integrity of my system. Currently, I'm trying to restore my boot camp partition and I'm having problem using WinClone, and their technical support is telling me I need to disable system integrity protection in order to do it. Would you say that it's okay generally to just leave it disabled? I'm not terribly worried about things, or should I be?
You know, I have
the initial reply.
Let me take this, and I actually put your follow up in Evernote, so you should have it now at the top of our MTG thing in Evernote once you sync up, or once we both sync up. So in terms of a general issue with system integrity protection, it's important to remember that SIP didn't exist for us before El Capitan. So it is less than a year old in terms of its public presence in any form, right? The betas or even certainly the release. Our systems were, you know, I'm using air quotes here, unprotected in that sense. And this is not to say that SIP is a bad thing, system integrity protection, SIP, that's what we're calling it here. But, you know, a year ago, it wasn't even on our radar as users. We weren't like all standing there with pitchforks saying, please, Apple, you know, lock down some portion of our system and protect us from ourselves and others. So we certainly can live without it. We did live without it. And you'd probably be just fine turning it off for certain operations. Know that it will potentially get turned back on by things as it is the default state and the OS is, you know, Apple treat it like a stable system where at some point, you know, I always think of stable systems as a bowl with a marble. You know, you can take the marble and put it on the edge, but at some point it's going to roll back down to the center of the bowl. And that's true with this. It will go back to being turned on even if you don't choose to do that. But it is, so it is best to learn to live with SIP enabled most of the time, because it is where we're going here, whether we like it or not. And for the most part, I have to say, I was not a fan. I'm still not a fan of the concept, but the implementation hasn't been horrible for me or for us in general here. You know, we haven't heard lots of horror stories from everyone listening here with, you know, there just hasn't been a lot of issue with it. We sort of know about it. And it's this thing that, yeah, we know our hands are sort of, you know, shackled in certain ways. But for the most part, it's kind of okay and it doesn't get in our way. And yes, I do understand that it makes us safer because there are these parts of the system that even if we authenticate as root users or admin users, we cannot touch. And so, I mean, I get it. It's a slippery slope. I don't know how much further I want to go here on this, but we're okay where we are. But you could turn it off, especially in limited doses, to do certain things. And I think that's where you want to take us, John.
And the thing is, I'm with you. The thing that they were trying to prevent, I think, is the thing that, quite honestly, I've seen plague Windows systems more than others, is that you want to be careful about allowing the root or the admin user to do certain things on a computer.
Yep.
And system integrity protection tries to limit both where things can be that can do, you know, potentially catastrophic, horrible things, or like signing, for example. That's one thing that they strictly enforce. So in the past, they'd be like, okay, well, you know, things, you know, especially these things called kernel extensions, which are kind of the bridge between your hardware and your software. Yeah, we'll, you know, we'll kind of let, you know, we'd like those to be signed, which, you know, means they should come from a developer that Apple knows about. But here's this whole huge list of exceptions.
Sure.
That we'll allow to get through.
Right.
So they're kind of breaking their own rules, and they finally tightened up on that a little bit. But also locations that things can run. Because if things are in certain places, that means they have, you know, certain abilities that
right.
other programs do not. The place where I wanted to go with this is that, so the problem is I'm not entirely clear on it. It could be where the thing goes. But Total Finder is something that I was using for a while. And I really kind of enjoyed using it because it added a lot of things to Finder that I miss. Like the other day, the one thing that I miss is that it would allow cut and paste in the Finder. You don't get that in the regular Finder.
Right.
You can copy and paste, but it's so much easier to cut and paste. And you know, the Total Finder guy or crew, I think it's just one guy, figured out a way to accomplish that. But I guess he had to, you know, kind of break some of the rules or kind of, you know, get intimate with the system, which system
sure.
integrity protection. Right now, his solution is you turn it off and then you can run Total Finder. The thing is, I've seen tweets from him saying, I'm going to be offering. So one, he's still questioning whether it's worth writing the software, because in order to enable the use of it, people are either going to have to disable this mechanism or, but he has promised to come up with a way that people can temporarily turn it off, install Total Finder, and then put it in a place that the OS is happy with, and then turn it back on.
Yep.
And that's the last I saw from him in his Twitter feed.
Yep. And so yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes to the page that explains how to disable SIP and get Total Finder in place and all of that stuff. Yep. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like your take was it's probably not a big deal if you disable it. The thing is, it opens you up
in the same way that you were open a year ago. And to point something out, because this is, you know, that herd immunity concept, right? Where is someone going to bother to write an attack vector that 99.9% of Macs are immune to? No. Right? I mean, you know.
True.
Right? I mean, it's just not worth your time. So
but I... I personally would not turn it off. That's my take.
Well, I wouldn't either, but it's not.
Unless you think you have a really good reason.
Well, now,
I don't know if running Total Finder is a good enough reason.
Yeah.
For you, maybe it is.
Right.
For me, it's not.
Right.
But if he has a workaround where I can turn it off, install it, and then turn it back on, then maybe I'll revisit it. Because I do miss that one feature when I really needed it, and a few of the others. That being said, but Apple's looking out for us. They're trying to protect us.
Again, it's good. It's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. Hey, I want to take a second and talk about the two sponsors I mentioned in the intro that work for you, my friend.
Outstanding.
All right. Our first sponsor is a new sponsor for us here at Mac Geek Gab, and that is HelloFresh at HelloFresh.com. HelloFresh is a meal delivery service. Well, it's a meal kit delivery service, right? You go online, you pick what you want, and then they send you a box. They can send you one box a week. You can have 3, 4, or 5 different meals in the box. But the thing is, you're going to cook these yourself, right? But they make it super easy, and it tastes so good because you get this box, and it's awesome the way they do it and make sure everything stays fresh and cold and all that in the box, as you would expect. But when you open this box, the box I got had 3 meals in it, and each meal was sort of self-contained in its own little mini box. And when you open these little mini boxes, it looked like someone had gone to the best produce section that you've ever seen and just hand-selected the best of each of these items. They just looked so perfect, and they weren't crammed in there. They had plenty of room, and they felt fresh. Hence the name, HelloFresh, right? So then there's also a little booklet, and it looks like, I mean, this thing's like a published booklet, and yet it's got the recipes for the ingredients for the meals that you ordered. So you take, you know, one of the boxes and you start to make the meal, and it tells you how long you need and all the ingredients that are needed. And of course, most of the ingredients are included. The only things that weren't were olive oil and butter. So you need to have that, and you need to have a stove and maybe an oven, but otherwise you're good to go. They got everything, you know, that you need. It prepares so easily. They've got everything for you right there. You just read through the steps. It's a fun thing. Totally makes sense if you're just a busy professional and you want to cook more at home. Or you're a family like mine where we're going all over the place. You know, so many times it's easy to just punt and pick up something, but it's not all that great for you. And this stuff is great for you. It's great tasting. They've got a dietitian on staff that reviews every meal. You got to check this out. So go to HelloFresh.com. And then when you're ordering, use coupon code MGG. That saves you $35 off your first week of delivery. So again, HelloFresh.com, and use the promo code MGG. You know where that comes from. And it saves you $35. It lets them know that you heard it here, and that works out well for all of us. Our thanks to HelloFresh for sponsoring this episode. Our second sponsor, how would you like some money? How would you like to get some money from a company that has paid out over $200 million? All you got to do, visit gazelle.com, tell them what you got, an old iPhone, an old iPad, even an old MacBook of some models. They'll tell you what it's worth. They'll send you a box. You put the stuff in the box. You send it back to them. They send you money. I'd like to note that the only time money is involved from your standpoint in that whole transaction I just described is when they pay you money. The box, that's shipped to you at Gazelle's cost. The box that you ship back to them comes with a shipping label prepaid by Gazelle. The only time you are involved with money is when you're receiving money from Gazelle. They've paid out over $200 million. They like to pay you money. And it's great. And then they take these things and they either refurbish them and sell them back individually, or, you know, they have different ways of recycling them and doing all the right things with them. So if you want a used yet reconditioned iPhone, well, go to gazelle.com. It's the same instructions, except instead of clicking sell, you click buy, and you're done. You just figure out what you want. And then at that point, yeah, you are sending them money, but then they're sending you a phone or, you know, whatever it is you wanted to buy. You got to check this out. Gazelle.com. It's the place where you're going to go to either sell off your unused smartphone and other devices or buy yourself a refurbished one at a great price. Check it out. Gazelle.com. Our thanks to Gazelle for sponsoring this episode.
Indeed.
Indeed. John, two more questions that I want to go through here because we'll see if we can get some clarity actually on this first one. Scott writes, guys, my wife just asked me, can I select all messages from, say, Travelocity and delete all but the most recent two? I can obviously show her how to do this on her Mac. She was looking on via her iPad at the time. But I know the real desire would be to have it happen for certain email addresses automatically, especially newsletters and promotions and sales, but not others, friends and that sort of thing. Since nothing jumped out to me, but I wasn't sure if either of you have seen this kind of feature before in any tool, add-in, or service. So this is a good question because it would be handy to say, I only want the two most recent emails from Travelocity, you know, to persist in my mailbox. And I'm not sure, you know, I feel like there's an option with smart mailboxes. Certainly if you're using Gmail, you can create some rules like that. But, I don't know the answer. Sanebox is definitely something you should consider. Sanebox is a service. We'll put a link in the show notes, but it's just sanebox.com. And this is a service, actually, I couldn't live without. I've been using it for a couple of years. What it does is it auto filters your mail as it's coming in, and it takes things like Travelocity, you know, the newsletters and promos, and puts them into a different, it just moves them into a different mailbox on your IMAP server, whatever host you use. And it's fantastic because it keeps your inbox for just the things that are there for your inbox. And you can totally configure it. It's, you know, it comes pretty well configured, but you can tweak it just for you. And it's very responsive and all that stuff. So Sanebox might be sort of I don't think it's going to do exactly what you want here, but it might solve this problem in a different way. But if anybody's got any thoughts about how to do exactly what Scott and his wife are looking to do, I'd sure love to
really
to hear about it. Yeah.
Okay. Because I was thinking a few things. So one, yeah. I mean, I actually already have a rule where anything from Travelocity or many of the people that I deal with, you know, vendors. Actually, I have a folder called Travel, and within my Travel folder, Dave, I have American Airlines, United Airlines, and I put all the emails. I've already created a rule that all sorts them nice and neat.
Sure.
And at that point, it's trivial to pull them out of there. Otherwise, I think, yeah, I think you the suggestion was a smart mailbox would be a nice way to do this.
Yeah. So yeah, but a smart mailbox would have to be done on the server, right? Because a smart mailbox on your Mac is worthless to deal with mail for, you know, I mean, if you're checking on the iPhone or whatever.
Right. So it's server-based.
Server-based. But, and that's, again, where Sanebox sort of came around for me. It's like, this might be, you know, again, it's a little bit different, but not all that different. So, yeah. I don't know. It's just a thought. So,
I mean, I guess in general, I guess the thing is, you know, if you don't have rules, whether they be server side or client side,
yeah,
think about creating them now because you want to avoid email chaos. Now, as you said, you know, Sanebox, and I know there are other very nice either email clients or systems that help manage your stuff.
Yep.
But now's the time to think about that because it gets out of control.
It does.
It will. It's not if it will happen. It will happen. Your email will, you will lose control of your email.
Yep.
You got to think of a way to organize it. So now is a good time as any.
Yep. Cool. All right. Well, I would love to hear your thoughts on that, folks. If anybody has, especially the specific answer that Scott's looking for, that would be great. And the last question, and then we have some tips to go through, actually quite a few tips to go through. Daniel writes, he said, I upgraded to a new Netgear GS108E gigabit switch, and I have to have something more reliable in the office. The switch connects to an Asus RT66U router upstairs through the Ethernet cable. Everything I connect to the switch works fine, besides my Thunderbolt display. In network settings on my computer, nothing happens, and it seems like there isn't a cable connected. And on the switch, both lights start to blink for 2 seconds and then stops and cycles back and forth. Can you point me in the right direction? Yeah. So what he's talking about, in case it's not clear, because we were talking about Ethernet and then suddenly Thunderbolt displays, the Thunderbolt display is also sort of a mini Thunderbolt dock, and it has, among other things, a gigabit Ethernet port in it, or at least in theory, that's what it has in it. So it should be able to connect to the switch. But, you know, there's a lot of these new switches. Netgear switches are interesting. They actually have some great features, but a lot of them are sort of dumbed down by default. And if it's a dumb switch, you can't get in and control it. But a lot of these switches have energy saving features where they turn off the switch if they're seeing that, you know, or they turn off a certain port on the switch if they're not seeing what they want. But that cycle that you're seeing where it lights up and then it goes off and then lights up and goes off means that the negotiation of the speed is not happening in the way that is making one side or the other happy. And it's just giving up on it. So the idea would be to go to System Preferences, Network, and then go to the Ethernet port in question. You could be seeing this problem with an Ethernet port on your, you know, there's the built-in Ethernet port on your Mac. It doesn't have to be Thunderbolt. I've seen this. In fact, I put myself into a problem with a thing like this. And then go to Advanced and go to Hardware. This is where you tell the port on your Mac how to behave. And you can have it in Configure Automatically mode, which would be the first way to start, because that sort of lets it negotiate whatever might need to be negotiated. And that would be the first place to start. My guess is you might already be there. And if so, then I would try changing that from automatically to manually and change the speed from auto select to gigabit, which is 1000 base T. Leave the duplex at full, the MTU at standard. And for the first test, leave AVB EAV mode on if that's an option for you. That's one of the power saving kind of negotiation modes. Hit OK, hit apply, and see if it brings up a connection. If it doesn't, go back here, leave it again on configure manually, change the speed to 100 base TX. Leave all the rest the same, hit OK, hit apply, see if that negotiates. If it does, then it means, OK, you can get a 100 megabit connection, but not a gigabit connection. And you can start asking why. Is the cable perhaps a problem? Is it, is that port? I know your switch is brand new, but these things happen. Is the port on the switch bad, right? And move to a different port, you know, with the cable. See what happens there. Try your Thunderbolt display with a different switch. See what it auto negotiates there with the cable, right? So you can say, okay, I know that the port, whatever port it is you're using, works at gigabit with this cable on that switch. So what's different about these two switches? And then at that point, you might go back and say, configure manually, do the speed at auto select, but turn off AVB EAV mode. That's the power saving thing. And that I've seen cause all kinds of problems with certain, but not all switches. So that's just doing a little troubleshooting in here. And it's a little tedious because you've got to go in and you've got to make the change and then hit OK and then hit apply. And then, it should either come up or not. But that's a handy place to do that from. So hopefully that helps. I hope that's the plan. Thoughts on that, John?
I hope too. I've always liked, Dave, to determine if your network connection is okay from the computer that is experiencing troubles.
Right. Well, that's what we're doing here is the computer.
Is the network utility info tab and where it shows especially sender receive errors. Like I'm looking right now on this machine.
Well, he's not going to have any errors because there's no data passing.
Yeah. So you got to wind things down. Yeah.
Right.
With your suggestion. But like, for example, in my case here, Dave, I'm looking at my gigabit connection from my Mac Mini to my switch.
Yep.
And it actually shows 4 receive errors, which actually makes me happy.
So you're using network utility to do that?
Yes. So network utility has an info tab, and then among the choices are all of your interfaces on that computer in question. So,
so how do you Wi-Fi. How do you go and run network utility? I do it by typing command space to bring up Spotlight, and I type network utility because I can never remember how to.
That's exactly what I do.
Navigate there. So okay, so there you go. That's
for me.
That's how to launch it. Yep,
dude. For me, most of the time, Spotlight is my app launcher.
There's a tip. If you're not, again, you know, this was the point of the whole quick tip segment, was to expose these things that we all use, you know, but not all, that we each use automatically, couldn't live without, but, you know, don't think about sharing. And here's a great tip. I think it's probably been a decade since we've talked about how we launch apps, right? I mean, certainly half a decade on this show. And this is it. Yeah, it's Spotlight. It's how I launch almost every app that's not automatically in my dock. It's command space.
Disk utility.
Yeah.
Almost all of them. And you know, the thing is, when I get a new system, I get cranky because it hasn't yet built the Spotlight index.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it doesn't work. And I'm like, where is this? Or yeah. I know where it is. It's either applications, or sometimes, like in the case of a lot of these utilities, it's in applications utilities.
But that's not where this one is. This one's in, you know, system library core services applications.
Oh, right. Yeah. Core services has several utilities that mere mortals will never encounter. But
these are good things. Yeah. And you're right. I've got 9 receive errors and no send errors on my Ethernet port on this iMac since
boot, in this case,
I assume. Yeah.
So out of 8 million packets received, 4 were encountered errors. And typically networks or most computer things will fix that. So I'm not surprised at that.
No.
But yeah, if and when you actually establish a connection, which you will also see in the window.
Right.
Like right now, of course, it says link status active.
Right.
Well, that's great. It says link speed 1 gigabit per second, link status active, vendor Broadcom, who makes the network chipset, and the IP address and the MAC address. But those statistics are useful. And especially if you suspect like substandard cabling, you're going to see those error numbers climb if you even get a connection. I like your solution of like hard coding it.
Well, so it's one way to troubleshoot.
Well, even though, you know, automatic should work.
Right.
A lot of times it doesn't. So you got to force the hand and, you know, maybe start at the slowest. Say, okay, let's start at 10 megabits. Then let's go to 100. Then let's go to, and you know, let's see where it starts breaking down.
Yeah. Yeah, 10, there might be some gigabit switches that don't support 10, though. I don't know that.
They have to. They have to.
They don't
have to. The standard says they have to.
Maybe they do have to. Yeah. All right. I would always, 100 is always where I, you know, sort of settle back in. But you know, like I was having a problem because I did this with a Thunderbolt Ethernet adapter. I have one of those connects Thunderbolt to Ethernet and USB 3 gigabit Ethernet and USB 3 things that I use with my MacBook Air, which is awesome. But at some point I must have been doing some testing with it and set it to manually do gigabit, right? Because I wanted to force that and test it, you know, for whatever reason. You know, I don't remember why. And then months went by. Everything had been working fine every time I tried to use it, which isn't often. And I had to test some power line adapters. Well, some will do gigabit, but these particular ones would only do 100 megabit. And I couldn't connect to these power line adapters. I'm like, I can't believe these things have burned out. Like, I'm not even using them. And finally, I realized, I'm like, oh, wait a minute. I'm forcing my connection to gigabit. And that, you know, that other device doesn't know how to do gigabit. So, you know, there you go. So anyway. You got to be aware. So it's a good place to check. See how that goes. All right. We've got some tips, some follow-ups from recent shows. Dave will start us off. In 594, we were talking about pasting plain text on iOS. And we have several tips for you. Dave is the first one we'll share. And he says, to paste plain text in iOS, I use a text expander touch snippet. My shortcut that I use is PTPT. And the shortcut content is simply percent clipboard. He says, in the iOS, in the edit snippet screen on text expander, it will show the status plain in the content heading that tells you that it will paste unformatted text. And he says, this method works great as long as you trust Smile enough to grant full access to the text expander keyboard, and I do. And you know, this also works on OS 10. And I can't believe I never thought to use this, because you can tell it to take whatever's on the clipboard and paste it as plain text. And so I've created this snippet, and I have it obviously on iOS and on OS 10 because it syncs back and forth between them with Text Expander. And I do PTPT now. And so thank you, Dave. I've already used it probably, I don't know, a half dozen times since I saw this 3 days ago when we were prepping the show. So good stuff, Dave. Thank you for that. Along those same lines, we have a note from Bill. And Bill says, I'd like to offer the following suggestion. On the Mac, I use a... Oh, he says the same thing. Oh, there it is. Okay. The Text Expander shortcut with the percent clipboard as the content and plain text as the formatting. So there you go. Thank you, Bill. And lastly, from Joe, along on the same topic, he says, to do this, paste the text into the subject line in your email. He says, if you want to paste text into an email that is plain text, he said, paste it into the subject line and then select it all and cut it from the subject and paste it back into the body. No app switching required, no third-party utilities required, and it works well with lengthy blocks of text and images get stripped too, so you'll actually get a scroll bar in the subject line, which is outstanding. And I tried this, and it even preserves line breaks, which it should, but I was surprised that it did. So handy stuff. Thank you very much to Dave, Bill, and Joe, and everybody else that sent us comments about that too. It was enlightening. I like it. Any thoughts on that one before we move on, John? I like the subject line one. That's I like them all, in fact. So,
yeah.
Yeah. All right. Moving on to James in show 595, we mentioned Drive DX as part of Cool Stuff Found. And James says, after hearing about Drive DX in episode 595, I downloaded and ran it. Drive DX immediately showed that there was a firmware update for the SSD I have in my Mac Mini. The update resolves a problem that prevents the computer from slowing down or hanging after it has been running for a specific number of hours. Thanks to your podcast, that problem has been averted for my Mac. So good stuff. I, you know, had no idea that Drive DX would do that. And that's the beauty of some of these good utilities. So thanks, James, for alerting us to that. And I think thanks, Pam, for telling us about Drive DX in the first place. So good stuff. Anything on that one, John, before we move on?
No, I like the things I've heard about their software.
Yeah.
It's smart, and I'm not being funny, mm-hmm. in that it's smart plus, because
right.
As we found, smart
ain't smart.
Isn't. And they kind of figure it out. They take the parameters from what I can see from, you know, the product description, and they say, you know, I think things are going to go bad. Whereas smart is just like, huh?
Here's some data for you. Would you like it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, smart is very binary. It's like either pass or fail. Whereas, you know, if you take the numbers and you churn and be smart about them, they can tell you when bad things are going to happen. And that's the feedback I've gotten from more than one person. So thanks, guys.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Finding the firmware. That hats off to them. That's pretty cool.
That is what I would consider above and beyond. I did not expect that, which is, again, perfect. So, all right, cool. Thanks, James. And now we will move to Jim with some more tips. He said, just a quick one for getting rid of files that may be hard to delete in these days of SIP. He says, boot from another drive, mount the directory containing the files you want to delete, and drag them to the trash. He said, in my case, I had leftover files from Carbon Copy Cloner Safety Net. From when I swapped my main boot drive and a backup drive, I tried many ways to delete them: permission changes, ACL changes, using sudo and ch flags as recommended by Apple. I downloaded a couple of apps that promised results. None of them worked. And he says, I learned it might be a SIP issue from the Carbon Copy Cloner help site, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. So this is very interesting, because we had. We had a similar exchange with listener Anthony about being unable to delete a file. And Anthony's solution was essentially quite similar to this. In the end, he said, I connected my iMac and MacBook Pro via FireWire, and I booted the iMac into target disk mode, and then dumped the file from the desktop to the trash on my MacBook Pro, then deleted the file on the MacBook Pro. So mounting it from another source was the solution. And his assumption at that point was that it was the iMac was holding it in an open state. That's not it. It's system integrity protection getting in the way. And the folks at Bombix Software are aware of this. And thankfully, in Jim's case, he was having problems with a carbon copy cloner file. So he knew, you know, some searching led him down the right path. Anthony, it was a different thing. So, but it can be, SIP can bite you. So,
well, it's maintaining the integrity of the files and that it's like, nope.
Yep.
Not going to let you delete that.
Yep.
Because I know best.
Yeah. Because I know best. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So interesting stuff. And thank you both for sharing. So, all right. Chester helps us with another one here with the iPhone 6S. He said, when I last wrote in, my iPhone's internal personality was suffering from a breakdown. This was that iPhone that was doing all sorts of crazy things. He said, you suggested that I do a restore from backup and see if that solved the problem. I never did that. Since then, it has started working. It was odd, and it started working more frequently and then giving me errors less often, and then it started working all the time. I guess it was the opposite of a slow breakdown. He says, you guys were talking, he says, now that I'll give you a couple of quick tips. You guys were talking about the keyboard on the new S series phones as a trackpad by deep pressing into it with 3D touch. That's something I've loved since I got the 6S Plus. Well, my tip is that sometimes it doesn't work, or at least that was my experience until I figured out why. If you move too quickly from typing and try to deep press into the keyboard, it won't work. You have to wait until the cursor starts blinking again. It's a slight delay, but once you know, it's no big deal. 100% success rate ever since. So I also noticed something that's probably not intentional with the trackpad keyboard mode on the 6S series of iPhone. So if you get yourself into trackpad keyboard mode, which is where, as Chester says, you wait in that, you know, wait till the cursor is blinking and then deep press on the keyboard, you'll get into trackpad mode, but you'll still see the keyboard there. It just, all the letters disappear. But here's something interesting. If you start typing on that keyboard, your digits or your letters will appear to the left of the cursor insertion point. Again, I'm not convinced this is intentional. I can't really think of a use case for it, but it is worth pointing out. So you'd have one finger, you know, on the keyboard as a trackpad, and then you could bring the other one in and start tapping letters. I don't know why you'd want to do that, but you know, hey, far be it from us to judge. I got one last one, John. Actually, I got two, but one last one from listener Tracy and then one from me. Tracy says, about your issue where your Mac seems to be unable to forget Wi-Fi networks, like the Logan Wi-Fi one, maybe you can blame your family for your Wi-Fi problems. Here's why. When checking my Wi-Fi list the other day, I noticed a huge long list of networks that I didn't recognize. As I went through the list, I noticed Boston_Wi-Fi. I've never been to Boston, but I realized that my coworker has, and my coworker has used my computer, was in Boston last year. When he and I started looking through the list together, we noticed places he has been, as well as his wife and my wife. My family shares an iMac, but we all have our own accounts on the iMac, but all of us sync our devices to the same computer, which means I'm getting their Wi-Fi networks. So this leads me to believe that even when I delete all of the Wi-Fi networks from my devices, as long as I share a computer, they will still repopulate. Does this make sense? And this is possible because on the Mac, it remembers Wi-Fi networks system-wide. So whatever network any user has joined, other users will automatically join, or that computer will automatically join that network for other users. So does that then mean that populates the auto join list on the Mac for each user for those networks? And then that, of course, gets synced over iCloud to all of your iOS devices. And here we go. It never forgets. So that makes there's some sense here. So there is one computer that we all share quite a bit in the house. Actually, there's two now. So it's possible that for me, that's what the issue is it keeps coming back. So I wonder if I go to that kind of main computer that we all share and pull these from there and see if the change will percolate out, not just to me, but to everyone. So I will look into that. It's interesting. I don't have another answer for it. Do you, John?
I threw up my hands the last time, Dave. I think I told you.
I know.
It was like 2 weeks ago. All of a sudden, my computer was connecting to not what I thought was my preferred network, which is the base station in my house. And then I looked at the list, and it was like a blast from the past. And the thing is, I'm the only one that uses my computers.
Right. Right.
I mean, I got my iMac, my MacBook Pro. My Mac Mini, my MacBook Pro, my iPad, and my iPhone. Those are the four machines. Those are the only four machines that ever use my iCloud. So yep. There's no chance of anyone that I don't know about. Well, maybe there is. Mm-hmm. I just think it got into a state where, I don't know, maybe there was a problem at iCloud Central and they were like, whoops, you know, something went wrong. Let's restore from a really old version of his cloud. And it's like, okay,
here we go. Yep.
Because I had seen things that were like places that I'd been at years ago.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Some don't even exist anymore, whereas you have the same problem.
Drives me crazy. So speaking of traveling, John, I was in San Diego this week for a couple of days to visit with a company called Smart Draw. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk more about this, I'm sure, as things move on. But Smart Draw is, it's a competitor to Vizio. It's an easy way to sort of describe it. But Smart Draw has been around for 22 years, but they've only ever made Windows clients that do this. Now, for those of you that don't know Vizio, and most of us Mac users probably don't, because nothing like this is really made for the Mac. There's some crummy alternatives, but
I wouldn't go that far. Well, Vizio, if I recall, lets you draw nice pictures, right?
More than that, it lets you draw intelligent pictures, and that's what Smart Draw does too, right? It you can do things. The one that really resonated for me, and I think will resonate with the show, is being able to draw a network map. So the idea is you tell it what you're drawing, and then you don't actually have to be able to draw, right? They have all kinds of symbols, which is another word for built-in shapes, right? Kind of like really smart clip art, for lack of a better term, where you go and say, okay, I'm going to draw a network map, right? And then it'll load these libraries of things that you might want in a network map, like things like, you know, switches and routers and firewalls and, you know, computers and devices and all that. And you can bring in other things too. They've got like, I don't know, I think it's 4,000 or 5,000 symbols in Smart Draw. Right. And then Vizio does the same thing. They have less symbols and really.
Well, I want to take it back. I was being kind of silly, but Vizio is Microsoft's, I would say, diagramming software. So it lets you draw flow charts. It lets you draw all sorts of diagrams to help people understand flows and things like that. So it's a huge, it does. So I've used it in the past to draw flow charts for software. You can use it for so many things, but it doesn't
work on the Mac.
Correct. You would have to run it under a virtual machine.
Because
it's part of Office and they never migrated it over to the Mac. But it sounds like these Smart Draw guys are focusing on a subset of the functionality, but they're also
a much larger set of the functionality than Vizio.
What? In that they do everything that Vizio does?
And then some.
Oh, okay. So I can like draw a flowchart with
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. It sounded like you were suggesting that it only did network stuff.
No, I picked the network. That's the problem is it's a kitchen sink app, right? So you have to pick something to talk about. But yeah, flowcharts, org charts. But the cool part about these types of apps, and Smart Draw obviously included there, but Vizio is this way too, is at some level, they're all smart. So as opposed to taking some drawing software and building, say, an org chart, right, or a network diagram, which you could do, and you could bring in clip art from the web or whatever. But when you take a group of items and move it, they don't move intelligently, right? You know, things don't move out of the way when you want to insert something in or whatever. You have to like manually move stuff out of the way. That's not true with these types of apps. And SmartDAW is really good with the way you move things around, and it just really intelligently relays it out because it knows what you're building. Well, there's never been SmartDAW for the Mac. There's never been Visio for the Mac. There's been some other software, but you know, I've tried some of them and none of them have stuck. Well, SmartDAW for the last 3 years, they decided they were going to rewrite SmartDAW, and they decided to do it in HTML5, CSS3, and JavaScript. And I got to check it out this week. You can check it out too at smartdraw.com. It's amazing how full featured this web app is. I mean,
wow, that's like platform neutral.
That was their point, right? Was not only do they want to use this as their platform going forward, you know, at some point they'll, you know, their Windows users presumably would migrate here whenever their Windows users are ready to do so. They could still use the Windows app, but it is feature complete, including file format. So if you have like, and it'll save to their cloud, but it'd save to Dropbox too. So if you are on your Windows desktop or whatever, and you edit a file and you save it to your Dropbox, and then you link your Dropbox to your SmartDAW.com account, you go to SmartDAW.com, you log in, and you can read that same file from the Dropbox. And I mean, it's amazing how they've you know, gotten all the vector graphics to work in both places. I totally forgot. They had me go through a couple of exercises while I was there so I could, you know, sort of learn how to use the software. By the third one, I forgot I was in a web browser. He started, you know, I was sitting with one of the engineers and I asked a question about something. And he's like, well, yeah, that's a good question. He said, we really had to, you know, work around the way the DOM worked. I'm like, oh, that's right. We're still in a web browser. Like, holy crap.
Document object model, DOM,
yeah.
All that great stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So,
that's a
it's pretty cool, man.
To make an app work on a web platform.
Yeah.
Is really hard to do properly.
It is. And like I said, they've been working on this for 3 years. Yeah. And they're smart people, and so it's. We'll talk more about it, but I was really, as you can tell, really excited to see this type of thing because there's sometimes, you know, I'm not an artist, but there's times when I want to visually get a point across, and software like this is super, super handy to do that. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there so that so you folks knew, you know, where I was this week, and also. You know, that this tool exists. It officially, I think it's in beta right now, but I believe it's coming out like the official release of the web thing. You can see it right now, but the official release is coming this week. So they were pushing changes, you know, like minor changes and all that good stuff. So it was fun. It's good. John, I think that's all we got today.
No, we always got more.
Yeah, we do. We did good, though, getting through stuff today.
More.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Feedback, you know, at Mac.
This, yeah. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Feedback at MacGeekHub.com is the email address that you can use to send email to us. Questions, tips. Go ahead.
And now, at the end, we are just stepping all over each other because, you know, Dave said... he said something, and I was going to jump in and also say feedback at MacGeek.com, where you can send.
MacGeekGab.com.
Ah, yeah. Right. I always screw that up. I'm so sorry. 2015. 2016.
That's right.
I said 2015 because I saw 15 on the calendar right next to 14.
It happens.
That's my excuse.
Yeah. Yeah, stick with that. No. That's good. Premium at MacGeekGab.com is the address to use if you are a premium member. If you want to learn about being a premium member, where you will get access to that premium at MacGeekGab.com address, which is prioritized for your questions, please visit MacGeekGab.com. We pushed a new version of the MacGeekGab app out this week. Finally, we made some Corey made some minor changes to it to fix some bugs and stuff for you folks. But and the app is free. You should go download it. But it got rejected, right? We've been through a couple of rejections. But this one was.
I don't know what's their problem.
Well, this time they rejected it because they're like, oh, well, you have this premium thing, but it's not an in-app purchase. And I'm like, well, okay, first of all, folks.
What's the problem with that?
This has been here for years. So why you're picking now, I don't know, you know.
So what, do they want a slice of it?
Well, they said, so I explained to them what premium was. And I said, look, to be honest, it's basically a donations model at this point, right? Yeah. And they said, but you have this premium email address where, you know, people can get stuff because they had researched it. And I'm like, that's true. They said, so technically it's not donations. If it was, you can link off site or, you know, to another website to do donations. But because you are offering this service, you know, that would have to be an in-app purchase, or you don't have to link to it in the app at all. So we don't. You can still log into your premium account in the app. We just can't have a link that says learn more about premium. And they were okay with that once we...
Really?
Yeah. I had a conversation with them. They called me and we talked it through. Yeah.
So it still sounds to me like they kind of maybe wanted a piece of that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was weird. I mean, they understood it, you know, so.
I get it. Well, you know, the good news is that, hey, at least somebody there is paying attention to some things.
Well, that's like the problem, is the inconsistency. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I said, I'll put it in there. But
hey, I'm all for that.
Yeah, but I don't want to give you 30%, you know. Actually, I'd be curious, you folks, because, I mean, I don't want to give up 30%, you know, but is there anyone out there that has not joined premium that would do so if we had an in-app purchase? Because if we're making it difficult for you, or if we're making it so difficult for you to do this that you're not doing it, well, then maybe we should do that for you. And then we'll just, you know, eat the 30% and that's how it goes. So I would be curious what you think. So write us or call us 224-888-GEEK, as we mentioned earlier, or find us on Twitter. John, why don't you tell them how to find us on Twitter?
There's so many ways to find us on Twitter. Us being, well, not just us, but me and you, Dave. So I am John F. Braun. He is Dave Hamilton. That other guy who is no doubt piloting his little heart out is Pilot Pete. The podcast is Mac Geekab, and the publication is Mac Observer, all at twitter.com/.
That's right. I want to thank all of you for listening. Seriously, thank you very much. Thank you for all your questions and everything. It really makes it makes the show work, right? So thank you sincerely for that. I want to thank our sponsors, as we mentioned, HelloFresh at HelloFresh.com, where coupon code MGG saves you $35. Also, Gazelle at Gazelle.com. I want to thank the folks at Smile, SmileSoftware.com/geek, Squarespace.com/MGG, where coupon code MGG saves you 10% off your first order. The wonderful people at MacSales.com, Otherworld Computing, Barebones Software at Barebones.com, and Casper at Casper.com/MGG, where coupon code MGG saves you $50. Get a better night's sleep. Why not? I hope you have a fantastic week. I hope you have recovered from the hour that you may have lost in this weekend's time change, if you're in the U.S. I think if you're elsewhere in the world and you do this winter-summer time change thing, that yours comes a little later, I think. I think we're all discombobulated here. But anyway, have fun. Pay attention to your clocks. And don't get caught.
Made up.